Gentlemen, are you still there? Is everybody ready?
Yes. Yes.
All right. Wonderful. Wonderful.
Mm-hmm. You black and you stuck in America. Now what? And you subject the police terror. You bite your tongue to tolerate that gang with badges and blues, but you bang on each other for brother step on your shoes. Open fire on the Mother's Day parade in New Orleans, but afraid to pull that strap to combat black unemployment. We just need my assistance from their politician. With nothing to lose, there's nothing to fear in the system. Ditch them, switch up, bump, bump, baby bump. The masses are hungry, but the wealthy ain't clear enough. Pack them alone, no a block of their cheese. So now we rock with a toilet.
Welcome to Black Economy Federation Radio. I am your host, Sherelle, and I'm filling in for Brother Lorenzo and Sister Jonina and Brother Ross. Tonight we're going to speak on a very, very important topic, one that does not get talked about in our community, and it's mental health. The mental health of our black community is something that we don't talk about, and we're going to discuss that tonight with two very important guests that I have. I have Mr. Kenneth Todd Nelson, and I have Mr. Chad Davis. Each of them are very, very interested and very, very active in our communities as far as working with our youth. Mr. Kenneth Todd Nelson, some of his accolades are he is an actor. He has a wonderful documentary that he's working on, and it's called The Face of Darkness. We'll talk about that a little later. And Chad Davis is currently working as a doctoral student in the wonderful state of New York. And he will discuss today some of the things that happen as far as depression and what he sees in some of the youth that he works with. So with that said, welcome, gentlemen. We are looking forward to a wonderful conversation this evening. How are you?
It's such a pleasure to be here, and thank you so much. I think this is so exciting just to be able to speak about. I think these very, very important issues, as you mentioned, Sherelle. It's just like something that we don't talk about often enough, and it's something that displays our community at such a a very dire way. And we really need to start to raise some of these issues, and I think we'll not only save lives, but also improve quality of life in many individuals.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we have a lot of our community that suffers in silence and a lot of misdiagnosed situations. If you go to the inner cities, you do see residuals of people who have mental issues or who would normally, if they had insurance or were employed, might be able to go to a doctor and discuss it or perhaps get some medication that would help them. With that said, Mr. Nelson, what is some of your observations? What do you see are some of the things that you see society has put on as a stereotype to a lot of our community, especially our black males? What do you see?
Oh, yeah, there's a lot. For someone that has that suffers from mental illness personally, and so myself, and, you know, I've done a lot of research and I've talked to hundreds of guys around the country. One of the things about it is there's a stigma associated with it. As young men, especially black men, they teach us at a very young age to be tough and, you know, don't cry like a little girl. And so we're embedded with that. And so that's how we grow up. And so self-expression, we don't deal with it. And, you know, it's always that hidden secret that, you know, a lot of people may think, but people just don't talk about it. They kind of sweep it under the rug. And I've noticed here recently, there are a lot of people that have been talking about it a lot more, especially this past year with a lot of the suicides that's happened. So I think that right now it's really, there's a movement happening. So I see people talking about it right now because in the past, I think there has been there's been stigma associated with it. But I think that there's something shifting in our community, and there are programs like yourself that you're doing right now and outreach programs that are definitely shedding a light on it. So I think people are definitely talking about it more now than what they were before.
And I totally agree with that. I'm going to read something from a magazine article that I found that was very interesting. And it talks about a young lady who was at the top, and she's African-American in her 20s, and she was making six figures in New York at the height of the Wall Street, situation. And everything collapsed, and she was one of the first ones to be laid off. She was living the high life, and all of a sudden that dropped out from under her. And she had to deal with the situation, and she didn't handle it well. Mr. Nelson, is that we're not used to going to someone to talk about it, therapy or something. You might be able to go to a preacher, and he's going to tell you, okay, let's pray about it, and that's it, or grandma say, oh, you'll get over it, or, those kind of things. So, that concerns all of us, and like you said, both of you, that we're starting to open up a little bit. It's that trust factor, I think, too, that has us not being able to, go to a doctor and talk about it. So with that said, Chad, what do you think about that? What's your take?
I'm so excited that we're touching upon this issue because the first I wanted to address is there is a very, very strong thing called stigma. It exists across many different attributes. So, obesity stigma is very huge. Stigma of HIV, AIDS, these are things across the globe that are common across cultures. There are stigmatized groups that it's almost like any group that you can look at, whether they're white, black, Asian, they're affluent or poor. There are certain groups that are stigmatized no matter what the population that might have biases against them are. And so a lot of the background has to do with this idea that let's say you have epilepsy or you have schizophrenia. People historically have viewed those illnesses as contagious, and they still do. There still is this lingering idea that you are infectious, that you have, you're depressed, or you can't handle your situation that you're going through right now, or that, you went to a psychiatrist, therefore, you must be sick. And there is this idea, this kind of inherent, implicit idea that most people probably couldn't put their finger on, this very subconscious, that they're afraid to be associated with that kind of person. And so I think that's kind of the core at all of all these ideas around, I don't just want to admit that I have a problem. I don't want to even touch the issue that I might have a mental illness that I'll be struggling with, because I don't want people to feel that I am broken or contagious, and I'm going to affect their life negatively. I think the second issue you talked about, which is huge in the research that I've been working on at Ford and in my PhD program, has to do with African Americans and their likelihood to seek out mental health services and the reasons behind it. And you touched upon a really, really important relationship between the church versus the healthcare system, because the healthcare system in our country has historically made some mistakes against African Americans. So if you think of the Tuskegee study, remember that they, when they had the syphilis study where they were testing African American men with different drugs, and then they ended up curing syphilis, but they didn't tell the African American participant that there was a cure available. So a lot of these men suffered from symptoms for many years without the cure that was available to them. And so things like that, and if anyone has read out there The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, and that talks about how, young black woman's mother, from a poor area, of Virginia, D.C., that area, she was a patient at Johns Hopkins, her her cancer cells were used, you know, without the consent of her or her family, and they were able to use her herself to remain disease. And so there's been a lot of, like, taking advantage of the African American community by healthcare professionals and researchers. And those have lingering effects. People are very untrustworthy of healthcare professionals. They don't trust they don't trust healthcare professionals, including doctors, mental health workers, nurses. It's this very, very, like, scary thing that they don't trust that they will be able to get the help they need. So what's happening is they're more likely to go to the minister who they see, and they might confide in him. If that person is from their community, most likely he's going to be the same color as them. And a lot of times, higher level, doctoral level, healthcare workers are not of the same color, so they don't feel comfortable speaking to them. And so, you know, while it's really a great benefit for people to speak out clergy members when they have, issues, yeah. The problem is a clergy member might not be able to, detect when something serious is going on, like depression, right, or suicidality, and they might not be able to screen that person and get the person the proper services they need to prevent any kind of, like, attempt on their life.
Absolutely. I just want to say something that's really important about what he just said. He said that people don't want to admit to it, but let me go beyond that. A lot of times, a lot of people forget admitting. They don't even know what they're dealing with. They haven't even been diagnosed. They know that people may know that they're going through something, but they're coping. They don't know what they're necessarily dealing with, because a lot of times mental illness, especially depression, can show up different type of ways. Someone could be there can be different types of behavior that's associated with it. There could be, you know, people being angry. You could be sleeping around with different people. It shows up different ways, and I think that we have a social responsibility to our family and to our friends. So when you see something that you might not know quite, it's not right, that it could be depression. Because the first thing, if someone says that you're depressed, they're not going to admit to that at all. I mean, there's a stigma that's associated with that word. And a lot of times there are a lot of people that are actually dealing with mental illness that don't even know it. So first of all, they have to be diagnosed. But beyond that, we have a social responsibility just to be aware.
Right. And I want you both to hold on to your thought right there. We're going to take our first break. And when we come back, we will continue our discussion on that very thing. How do you recognize, you know, how do you recognize, and then how do you feel comfortable? Because we have been so inundated with people putting drugs and alcohol in our neighborhoods so that people self-medicate. Mm-hmm. And, you know, suppress those feelings. So let's go ahead and take our first break. And when we come back, we'll continue our discussion about depression and mental health in our Black community.
You are tuned in to the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts and live program scheduling, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com.
Okay. Welcome back to Black Autonomy Federation Radio, and we are discussing mental health in our Black community, and we are talking with Chad and Kenneth. And we have some very interesting observations. I wanted to talk about something that's a staggering figure. It looks like in the last couple of years there have been some statistics that have came via some of our mental health experts, and they've noticed that the suicide has increased in our Black males between the ages of 10 and 14. Again, that's something that, you know, we as a community and we as a people don't talk about. But it has come to the forefront with social media, with television, and all the world to see what's in our communities now. It is noted, and you know, some famous people have had issues with mental health, and so we want to talk about that as well. So with that said, I'm going to go ahead and talk about that with you, Kenneth, because I know you are doing a documentary that talks about you know, some of the famous people that have you know, expired because of their depression. So you want to elaborate on that a little?
Yeah, definitely. But do you? I think it's very important to understand. Do you mind if I share a small personal story first? Is that okay with you? Because it will kind of segue into that.
Yeah, we have to be cognizant of our time, but yes, and then we're going to tie some things into our prison system and our jails. But yes, go ahead.
Okay, well, definitely, I'll make it quick because I think it's important to the story. I personally suffer from mental illness myself, some depression and anxiety. I lost both of my parents within like a 2-year span, and I was ashamed, you know, to talk about depression when my doctors first diagnosed me with it. And so, this is an issue that has, I've been dealing with for quite a few years, and I had never talked about it with any of my friends. I'm an actor, television and film actor, and a lot of my friends are actors and in the business as well. And one of my close friends about 9 months ago died by suicide, Lee Thompson Young. He was on with the TV show with Zoli and Isles and the famous Jet Jackson. And I had no idea, for starters, that he was even suffering like myself. When he died by suicide, I was completely shocked. And then I start realizing that, you know, there are a lot of young brothers like myself that are suffering in silence. Because a lot of times, you know, we would sit down and we'd talk about sports. We'll talk about, you know, everything else, but we would never talk about that because it was something that was not socially accepted. So there are a lot of people on a daily basis. If you turn on your television, you'll see it's unfortunate that people are committing, dying by suicide on a daily basis.
Right.
And that's why I thought it was very important to do this documentary, the Face of Darkness documentary, because, you know, as being a young African-American male, I hid behind, you know, my smile. I didn't tell anyone what I was going through. Then I started asking other friends, and I would bring it up at the dinner table, and everybody would, you know, look at me like I was crazy. But then I would get text messages, or I would get phone calls saying, yeah, you know, I thought about, you know, committing suicide, or I tried it, or I had seen a doctor, or I felt this way. So then I start realizing there's a major epidemic that's happening. So I said, you know, let me do something about it because I have a responsibility, because I've experienced it personally and I lost a friend. So I've dedicated my life to bringing the awareness about this issue.
Very good. And we appreciate that you do that. And you brought up a good point there. You know, I can definitely attest to, the mental illness in my family. It runs, you know, from my grandmother that I never knew. And that's because she, you know, at a young age committed suicide. And then, you know, I watched my mom go through her depression. And, you know, I think you all brought up a good point. You don't know what it is. You just know they're sad, or you know, there's a different kind of behavior, you know, be it, you know, going out and having some sort of eating disorder or drinking disorder or drugs. You know, there's so many vices that we try to hide it and medicate it, or we do something just not to think about it or talk about it. And when you look back and you say, oh, well, that person was, you know, they were really just depressed. Or if you're in the school system like I am, you see anger. You see a lot of anger, especially in black males. You see the anger and you see the fighting, and then you see, you know, they have to go home to a depressed situation, unemployment, and, you know, and not, there's no insurance so that they can go speak to someone about it. And, you know, and so we have a crisis, basically, and which is leading to our children actually going into the juvenile system with anger issues. If they were able to speak with someone, maybe that, you know, if the school recognized, or, you know, we had some sort of program in our communities to help our own, then, you know, we might not be able to fill up these prisons or jails. And so I wanted to talk about that too, the correlation and the misdiagnosis that's done, and the mental, so our jails are filled with mental, you know, people with mental issues. So you want to talk about that a little bit, Chad?
Yes, I would love to. I think there's like, you know, when we think of like certain mental illnesses, we have a, you know, we have a certain picture in our heads of what that is. So when people think of something like depression, you know, they kind of think of like, you know, they look at the commercial of antidepressants. It's usually like a white female that maybe be crying, you know, and she's kind of huddled in the corner. And so she has the, you know, she has the fear, she has the tearfulness and she's sad and, you know, she's, you know, she can't really do much. And that's not the kind of behavior that we often find, and men, especially when you talk about African American men, they tend to African American men that experience major depressive disorder, they actually tend to exhibit things like aggression, irritability. They might, like as you said, engage in more externalizing behaviors, like substance abuse, or they might get into a violent situation, commit crimes because they just don't know how to handle it. They have a lot of emotions around it, and they just don't know how to deal with it. There's no coping mechanism that they've learned. And I think that is the reason why they consistently get misdiagnosed, and then they get the wrong treatment for what they need. So I think what you want to segment here in the next segment, I think you're going to be speaking a lot about, you know, the juvenile justice system. And what happens is that, you know, at a young age, a lot of these, you know, young African American boys are, you know, experiencing those early signs of, aggression, that they can't get out, they can't stay in their seat because they don't know what to do. You know, and they might start fights. And then people will know, oh, that person has conduct disorder, that person has oppositional defiant disorder, they're a bad kid, they just need to get their act together and behave correctly. So we're gonna actually punish them, we're gonna suspend them, and, we're gonna pretty much like send them into this, what they call the school to prison pipeline. Let's coin the term, is that, you know, these African American men are pretty much going from school to prison. It's pretty much like a pipeline where they just send them there, and part of it is that they're being punished very early on. There's a statistic that says that they're three times more likely than white counterparts to be suspended, and then they're much more likely to be arrested at the school for something they did. And it you know, when they control for all the other variables, it sounds like ethnicity has a big component in the bias, why those kids get sent into the correctional system very early. And what we find is that those kids never get the they most likely will never get the services they need if they're having depression, because, you know, the people that they encounter in that system especially are may not be able to screen for that and treat them for that.
Right. Totally agree with what you said, and I'm going to touch on something really briefly before we go into our next break. You know, there's the pressure of, first of all, to be employed. Secondly, you have to be 10 times better than your white counterpart to hold on to a job. And then if you go through our school system and you do make it and you do get your college degree, and you do get your doctorate degree, and, you know, then you say, then what? And you should be able to step to a job, but there's no job. Or they're going to make you last in line, you know. So you have that sort of stigma as well. You're doing everything right, but you're still being, you know, oppressed and held down. And so we as a society, or as a community, have to deal with that as well. So you're darned if you do and you're darned if you don't, you know. So we really need some tools in place to help, recognize and then, talk about it openly and freely without being convicted. So I'm going to end on that note right there. We're going to take our next break. And after this break, we're going to invite our audience to call our studio line. And the number to call in is 704-951-5030. And we will pick up where we left off. This is Black Autonomy Federation Radio. So I can't get around
it. So long, you can't get around it. Never miss an episode of Black Autonomy Federation Radio. Get the podcast by going to Black Autonomy Federation Radio. blogspot.com. It's a chance to dance your way. Now the
restrictions out. Welcome back to Black Autonomy Federation Radio. My name is Sherelle, and we are talking about a very important topic in our community. We're talking to two wonderful gentlemen, Chad and Kenneth Todd. And so we left off, we were talking about how there's a double standard, basically, for, you know, those that are successful in our society and those that are the underdogs in our society. And so I want to touch briefly on both of those subjects, actually, and I'm going to ask you, Kenneth, so you look, say, at your friend, the actor. You look at him and you say he has everything. What is it that, you know, we didn't see? What went wrong? You know, he took all the steps that he was supposed to take. So let's talk about that for a minute. I'd like you to just kind of expound on that. What are some of the things that we can look for?
Well, this is what I'll say, and I'll speak overall and just in general, and dealing with him as well. You never know what someone is going through. The darkness that they are experiencing. You can think someone has it all, and that's what people think, but you never know what someone is going through emotionally or when they're by themselves in the dark. And so especially with my friend, he was suffering. I mean, he was suffering in silence. And a couple people may have known what he was going through, but it wasn't something that a lot of his other friends knew about. Of course, now there's this major movement, with his family and myself and other people that are trying to definitely shed light on this. But that's just like you and I, or or the people that are listening right now. I mean, a lot of times you do not want people to know what you're going through. And I think that if we will allow ourselves to be vulnerable, there's something that happens when you're vulnerable. There's this relatability that's there. And I think that conversations like this and other conversations, even if it's one-on-one, because I'm a firm believer, and you don't have to necessarily put your business out there, but if you can definitely find one person that you can talk to, I think that's where it starts. And you said something very, Chad said something important earlier, and I think we need to, I don't want to like let this go because I think it's very important. We talked about church. As being an African-American male, and being from down south, and even living in New York now, I mean, that's where we go. We go to church to get a lot of our inspiration. And I think that we have a responsibility at our churches to teach, to be able to inform people with this issue. I mean, I think pastors need to be trained now to deal with this issue. You can't necessarily pray to worry, but you can pray, because I'm a believer in prayer. But at the same time, here are some tools that you have that will help you along your journey. Not only that, one thing that I will say, as being a black male and even as black women, where do we all go? We all get haircuts and we all go get out, and women go to the beauty parlors. You sit down in your barber chair or the person that's doing your hair, and you sit down and you talk to them. We need to start doing more outreach programs out there like that as well, because that's who we talk to.
I would love to jump on that right away because, what he's talking about is the most necessary step, I think, to get disseminating some of this information to our community. And I'll put a lot of the onus, forgive me, my colleagues out there, on us mental health professionals and physicians. We as healthcare professionals have to disseminate the information so that people are aware. And I think a great idea that Kenneth had is working with the community organizations that already exist that people go to. I mean, how can we work with them, build relationships with them so that they trust us? We kind of start to correct some of those mistrust kind of things that people have now of healthcare. And because we make collaborations, we speak to them on their level. And we, as psychotherapists, go out to the communities, meet the pastors, meet the barbers, and we say, hey, you know, could you help us get some information out there? Can we do a rally? Can we do a potluck, a fish fry, anything to get people to talk about this issue? And we'll, you know, we'll do a little educational component where we tell people this is what depression is. This is what it looks like. All those things just seem to be, ostensibly like easy solutions, but they...
I hate to interrupt you, Chad, but we do have a caller, and we're going to pick up again in a moment. But we'd like to go ahead and welcome our caller. Please identify yourself and let us know what your comment is, or if you have a question. Hello? Caller?
They dialed in by mistake, I assume. Please continue.
Okay, we'll go ahead and continue with the show then. And so with that said, Chet, I think and Kenneth said that the places where people feel comfortable speaking, you know, you just you feel comfortable in that respect, you know, in those places. And I think you guys, both of you, that's a great point. And the other thing too, okay, so the double-edged sword on that is, as a young person, you have to think about this too. And this is another aspect of depression and that hidden secrecy of things that are not supposed to be talked about or taboo. When you do go to a trusted coach or you go to a trusted minister and things happen that should not. And so, you know, in our community, we don't talk about things like that. That's something that adds to that depression, that anger. And, so we have to get used to working with it, people who they're, you know, just opening them up. And so what do you think we, you know, other than going into some of the community places that people, you know, just gather, and organizations like ours, Black Autonomy Federation, who have, you know, we have some of the tools in place that we go into and have a community meeting where we want people to open up. You know, other than that, is there a nationwide thing that we can look into, or should we start at the community level?
I would love to respond to that. I think part of it has to do with, we live in a very celebrity, infatuated society. Things like autism and certain issues, HIV, like when Magic Johnson made the HIV announcement about 20 years ago, 25 years ago, that was really important, steps, for getting information out about HIV and the kind of how it affected African Americans. And, maybe we need to have more, celebrities, those kinds of people that are admired, from different aspects of industries, athletes, entertainment professionals, politicians that come forward and say, hey, I dealt with depression, I dealt with anxiety, I dealt with substance abuse, or I know a friend that did that. My wife died, she committed suicide. And I think, the new mayor de Blasio, his daughter, did a similar campaign, in New York, 6 months ago during his, mayoral, election time. She was talking about her, as a young Black woman, her experience with mental illness and substance abuse. And I think that those kinds of things are very helpful just because, if you think of media, how many times do you see, violent crimes is what, Black men are, shown doing in media, or in television or on the news. It's always the Black men committing crime. But what about the Black men that commit suicide? Why is that on the news? And so there is a responsibility of the media and of people out there who have a voice, who can start to shed light on this issue, to come forward. And I know on behalf of mental health professionals, you know, I would, maybe I speak for myself, I would love to be a part of it, maybe making something that happen, like collaborating with people that have more of a public voice and seeing if we can get some of this information out there.
I agree. And you know, and Kenneth, we're going to get to you in just a minute, but one of the things that, that kind of frightens me is that, you know, again, that trust factor, your politicians and your minister, I mean, there's more negative in that light than there is positive. And so when you really actually go into a community such as ours and in everyday life, you're going to see the you know, people trying to get to work or finding a job, or you'll see homeless. In Chicago, you have more homeless children now than ever in history. And that's going to be a whole, in 5 years, that's going to be a whole different world that we're going to have to deal with. And, you know, so when you see just children without parents, I mean, let alone having parents that were depressed, angry, or drinking, or in some form or fashion trying to medicate themselves so they wouldn't have to deal with their depression or anxiety. These are children who have to deal with just life, period. So, you know, I have a deep concern about that. And, you know, I don't know that our people who, you know, I hate this, probably doesn't sound politically correct, but who up there or out there cares, you know? Otherwise, these children would not be homeless, depressed. You wouldn't have war veterans out here that have gone over and fought in our wars homeless, you know, and having to deal like with that. I think our mental health in the United States is the worst. You know, it's just poor, period. Yeah. You know? So, Kenneth, is there anything that you would like to contribute to those?
Yeah, definitely. I think there are a lot of people that care. It's just about how do you go about doing something about it. I think that collectively a lot of people think that their voices are, or their thoughts or their feelings are not valid, and they are. I think collectively we need a strong voice that can help with this movement. You think about the civil rights movement. We had people like Martin Luther King that was part of that movement who voice was very powerful. He spoke for the people. I think that we need a major ball player that will speak to this issue and will not be ashamed and will tell the truth. And I think that we're getting close. I know we have one, we have Brandon Marshall who, you know, he donated, I think maybe $1 million of his salary to help with the mental health community. But there are so many other people up there that I feel like there's something shifting in our community right now, and I think that we're almost there. I think we're very close. So I don't want people to necessarily think that people don't care, because there are people that care, and there are people that are trying to do things every single day. I run into them, and we're trying to make a change, because our people are suffering. They're dying on a daily basis. So I just don't want people to think that people don't care, because we do care, and we're actively trying. I know that I'm trying every single day. Every single day I'm doing something about this. So I think that we're almost there.
I thank you for that. Thank you for that. And I didn't want, you know, I don't want the audience to think that there aren't people who care. What I'm saying is, you know, the emphasis through our social media and our media is not focused on helping, you know, like.
Yeah, right.
You're absolutely right.
I mean, people care more about what Kim Kardashian's wearing than you know what's really, you know, I mean, that's what we talk about. You're absolutely right.
I think more importantly, I think what we find is that there's a lot of overt biases against certain people that are suffering in certain ways. So we have people that stigmatize obesity, and we have people that stigmatize substance abuse. And so when you think of people, oh, he's a drug addict, he's a heroin user, you know, he's a crackhead, you know, he's a nobody, you know, that person is depressed, that person has schizophrenia, you know, he might have a lot of other issues that he's dealing with, that the drugs are just, you know, they're now entangled with all that because it's not how they'll cope with it. And so I think there is just this, you know, this tendency for for professionals and non-professionals across different cultures, especially in America, to stigmatize those who are suffering in any way. And so I think, you know, while there are people that are doing their darndest, like Candace and his whole crew of documentary filmmakers, they're really trying to get the word out, and that's what we need more of, with compassion. But there are a lot of people in many different walks of life that look at struggles like that, and they say, oh, that person's weak, that person's dishonest, that person is untrustworthy. And yeah, those kinds of attitudes actually hurt the progress of the person. And, you know, even if the intention of the person was to shame the person into getting better, we often come across that in my work with obesity, is that people think, oh, you know what, you know, I'm going to tell that person that they're too heavy to eat that they shouldn't be doing mm-hmm. that. That's going to motivate them. And it's the opposite. Usually it actually discourages them and leads to weight gain. So.
And what Chad, he brings up a great point. Do you know that there's so many different elements that are components that contribute to mental illness? Food, for example, there are food deserts that they call that are in our community that we don't necessarily have nutrition in the Black community, that people have access to fruits and vegetables. You know, a lot of times when they go out and they eat food that is fattening, and all of those contribute components of your well-being, and that contribute elements that help that contributes to your mental illness. Another thing, I know when I was going through depression, no one told me I was eating a lot of sweets. Sweets would make me feel really, really good, and then all of a sudden I would crash. No one is giving anyone this type of information. I just found out probably about 3 months ago that I have a vitamin D deficiency. That's from the sun. I mean, people are not educated on this information. And I think that people need to know, because there's so many different components that contribute to this process.
Absolutely. And, you know, we're going to pick this up in just a few minutes. We're going to take another break, our last break. And then I just love the way you ended that, Ken. The food deserts and diet and depression are very, very much hand in hand. So, let's go ahead and take our last break. And when we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We'll see you in a minute.
Tune in to Black Autonomy Federation Radio broadcast every Saturday at 8 o'clock p.m. Eastern.
Welcome back to Black Autonomy Federation Radio. My name is Sherelle, and we are having a very, very good conversation today about a subject that does not get talked about in our community very often. We see it, we witness it, and it is starting to take notice. And through the wonderful work of Kenneth and Chad, we are a little more comfortable in our communities in bringing this subject out. One last thing that I wanted to touch base on is a lot of, like you take this city, Los Angeles, for example, there are a lot of people who see and witness violence, and it's either police activity or perhaps, violence in the community. Just recently we had a very famous actor who killed his wife in front of his kid, you know.
Yes.
So those kind of things, I think, unless they're addressed, they stay, and it's almost like these children are in a war zone, and they have, post-traumatic stress. Stress, and that is going to take a hold if we don't address it. So I wanted each of you to talk about that and our children perhaps some things that we can do in our school systems, maybe retrain our law enforcement officers. Tell me what your thoughts are there. And we'll start with
you. I think you mentioned really important, diagnosis that we are now getting more familiar with, thankfully, is PTSD. I think it's historically been associated with war, with war veterans. They had the symptoms when they returned, they're irritable, they're anxious, they're fearful, they have flashbacks to the trauma that they witnessed. But this is not just for war veterans. This is for, like you mentioned, someone that witnesses an act of violence, in domestic violence. This is someone that was raped, sexually abused. And these are things that African Americans suffer from more greatly to compare to Caucasians. And so there's a higher prevalence, but there's much more of a need in our community to, like you said, prevent maybe the expression of something like PTSD or maybe depressive disorder. And starting early on is the best solution, it seems like. I think part of this, one solution I could think of off the top of my head would be, again, doing more work within the schools. How can we, instead of like we talked about earlier, how can we have a less punitive measure? So if a child has witnessed a trauma or is experiencing violence in front of them daily, he's going to, he might model that behavior, in the classroom. Maybe he exhibits violence himself. So again, they might denigrate him. They might punish him, call him a bad kid, and his self-esteem will be lowered, instead of using that as an opportunity for him to be engaged in the healthcare system. And so how can we, maybe get more, relationships with between school administration and healthcare professionals, especially mental health professionals. And there's probably even ways to do it for free where you don't have to, because it's very hard with a budget, hiring a school psychologist, hiring contractors is very expensive, and there's so many children that they need to help, and it's not a lot of time that they have to interview each child clinically. But maybe there's a way to get other, healthcare professionals in there that maybe are studying for their licensure, or they're another healthcare professional, or they're a volunteer that maybe have some training in that could be used, and they could refer them to higher levels of care if needed be. But I think, getting more, services out there available, and that people know about is a first step, and early intervention is, I think, like the best recipe, as you mentioned, Sharon.
Absolutely. And Kenneth, what is your take on that? I'd like to hear your opinion.
I would agree 100% on everything that you stated, but my belief is really, of course, there's social responsibility. I think that, just if you see something, say something, or if you feel something, right. Because there are a lot of people that see things that just, that, they overlook it, but that very moment could actually save someone's life or save them from a lot of agony. I think that we definitely need to have more outreach programs out there, but then I think there's not a one size fit all. There's not a, there are different forms of treatment, or there should be different forms of resources that should be out there. Some people, there are medications, there's therapy, there's holistic measures, there's so many different elements there, to help people. And I think that people need to be able to choose what's best for them, but they need the information so they can be able to make a choice.
And you brought up both of you, very good solutions and beginnings. And if we, first of all, in any problem, you have to acknowledge it. You have to take responsibility, and you have to own it. And when you feel that you are part of that, and you can help instead of, shy away, or maybe I don't need to get involved, when you just, take that step, hey, is there anything that you could talk to me about, or and you can recognize, if you see somebody, you can recognize, the ups and the downs. I mean, just like I had said earlier, my family, I've been depressed, and I've chosen not to take the medication, but I get out there and I'm doing something holistically, or there's a, if we just offer those tools, you know, and we recognize in ourselves what's wrong, that anxiety coming on, or that, you know, wanting to eat, or you know, just lay in the bed all day. You know, there's people who do that just can't get up. They're just frozen. You know, they just can't do it. If they learn to recognize that this is an issue, and it's okay to have that issue, but this is what you do and use to get past that. So
you'd be surprised. There are a lot of people that feel that they're alone. A lot of people are listening. A lot of people out there, they feel alone. But to be honest with you, there are a lot more people that go through what you go through. It's just, you just don't know it because everyone is keeping quiet about it. And I think that if we start sharing our stories, if we're open and we communicate, and we, even if it's just with one other person, like I said before, I mean, there's a lot of breakthrough that happens. I mean, I know that just, there's a difference between men and women as well. For women, I do, even when I think their process, I'm not a woman, but you know, I've talked to several women. A lot of times when they're hurting, or they're thinking about suicide or different things, you know, they do things that are a little bit more, Chad, you may have to help me with this, but I know a lot of times with men, I think 5 to 1, if they're thinking about doing something, they're going to do it. And with women, they're a little more passive aggressive.
Right. Yeah, you're totally right. You hit the nail on the head. Absolutely. What they know in the research is that men, women are much more likely to make attempts. So, you know, they might swallow the pills. They might do things like that that are less likely to kill them. So they make attempts. So, it's unsure that are those more signs of like reach out or what it is, but like men are more likely, they make fewer attempts, but they make the most completions. So like it's a lot more dangerous when you're looking with a man, because if you're not recognizing any of the symptoms he's going through, because you think that he's an angry person or irritable, you don't see that he's depressed or suicidal. You'll never anticipate that he's going to kill himself. Whereas women, you know, you might be more likely to catch some of their symptoms early because you have this very stereotyped idea of what depression is, and then she will do something to show that she is, you know, thinking about suicide, and you'll catch that. And so I think there's much more work that we need to do, especially with men, really getting some of the information out there, telling men, you know, hey, this is actually what depression might look like. You actually might be depressed. You might feel sad, and that, you know, and that's okay. And sometimes men cry, and sometimes, we don't always have it together. Sometimes we have moments that we have to, go through that might be embarrassing and might feel emasculating. And so having that conversation, the dialogue, might help them.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I totally agree. I think we are on the right track. I think Black Autonomy Federation is really organizing and reaching out to our community, because we know in order for us to survive, we have to lift each other up, and we have to work things around our community, inside our community, self-sustaining gardens, and helping with our diets, educating our children, giving them self-confidence. If they have a problem, here's who you can talk to, giving direction. So we are working hard to do so. Gentlemen, I just want you to each give a 1 minute final thought on this conversation tonight, and we might have another one, because this is just opening the doors. So, final thoughts, Kenneth?
Definitely. I just want people to know, of course, like I said, they're not alone. I've dedicated my life to helping people, men, women, it doesn't matter, black or white, but especially in the black community. And I want people, if you guys are, you're listening, support your community. Definitely, like I said, I'm working on a documentary right now called Face of Darkness documentary. You guys can watch it on Facebook, the trailer's on YouTube. Send it to people, because you'll see yourselves, you'll see your husbands, you'll see your brothers, or no matter who it is. And I think this is healing can begin. And I just want people to know that they're not alone.
and that you can get through this. I'm someone that's thriving. I have mental illness, but I am thriving despite of it.
Mm-hmm. Good. Very nice. Good. And Chad, thank you.
Yes,
thank you for that.
And I would like to say, I would, you know, it would be, I think it would be wonderful if there was a movement that had to do with compassion. I think that compassion is something that, you know, that we as psychotherapists, that's our bread and butter training. Like, you know, just learning, what the other person's perspective is. If the person has committed a crime, violent, you might think that person is a murderer or a hateful person, a thief, you know, but what about that person's life made them do that? And what can we learn from that person? And how can we help that person and communicate to that person and speak to them and treat them as a human being? And I think those kinds of initiatives, either at the small level or the big level, policy level, national level, we can start to, you know, facilitate some of the dialogue that will be necessary to change some of these stigmatizing attitudes towards certain groups of people, whether they're obese, whether they are offenders, whether they are people that struggle with different mental health issues.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Well, gentlemen, thank you so very much. We just want to let everybody know out there that you can definitely reach us at Black Autonomy Federation at organize.the.hood@gmail.com. And both of our guests will post their email addresses up on our website and also our Facebook pages. We have our Black Autonomy Federation Facebook page. We also have the Black Autonomy Federation Los Angeles and Northeast. So we want to thank both of you gentlemen. You have been excellent, and I really appreciate your time today. I like to tell our audience, don't be afraid to talk about it. This is a conversation that we should hold dearly to us and just keep lifting each other up. Have a pleasant rest of your afternoon or evening, and thank you for joining us at Black Autonomy Federation Radio. My name is Sherelle. Have a great weekend.
Stuck in America.
Now what?
And you subject the police terror. You bite your tongue to tolerate that gang with badges and blues, but you bang on each other for brother step on your shoes. Open fire on the Mother's Day parade in New Orleans, but afraid to pull that strap to combat black unemployment. You get snared by the assistance from their politician. With nothing to lose, there's nothing to fear in the system. Ditch them, switch up, bump, bump, pretty bump. The masses are hungry, but the wealthy ain't giving up. Pack up a load, blow a block of their cheese. So now we rock with a tournament to make them drop to their knees. Exploitation of our culture, fake and shaking in Harlem. That's why I got no problem when the homeless come to rob on Black Autonomy's anthem. So my comrades are cranking, vegetarian, but down to put a pig in the blanket. We go
educate, agitate, unify, mobilize.